Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, you'll learn about the Climate Crisis Solutions Forum coming to Glen Helen. Then WISO's Wyatt Sowers talks with Antioch students about their experiences at the People's Climate March in this month's edition of the Antioch Word podcast. And later, commentator Bob Brekka asked how much could sea levels rise and when. Up first, as Election Day draws near, several Clark County races have heated up. WISO's Wayne Baker spoke with political analyst Rob Baker from Wittenberg University.
This midterm election seems pretty charged, but do you expect to see a bigger turnout? What do you expect to see turnout-wise?
I think the turnout is going to be relatively similar to other midterm elections, particularly in the local elections. There are some races here that are competitive, so that they may bring out the turnout a little bit higher. But generally speaking, I don't see turnout to be much different than previous elections of this sort.
What are some of the competitive races in Clark County, and why are they competitive in your estimation?
Well, let's start with the 79th House seat here in the General Assembly. With Ross McGregor being termed out, that creates an open seat, and obviously some competition for that between Kyle Kaler and Daryl Jackson. That race is pretty interesting, given the fact that Mr. Kaler had a pretty competitive primary race. There was some division there in the Republican Party in the primary, and some controversy in that particular race, but he came out on top, and that generated interest, I think, from the Republicans. With Mr. Jackson running for the Democratic seat, he's been campaigning pretty hard, and given the fact that this particular district, I think, is a fairly competitive one, and it's not a what I would call a gerrymandered district for one party or the other, I think you're going to see that that will be a pretty close race, I think. Another race that I think is pretty competitive is the race for county commission between Rick Lowness and the candidate David Harrier for the Democrats. Some of the decisions that the county commission has made in the period of time since Mr. Lowness got on have generated some controversy. The Kona Cranes decision, for example, as well as some other issues related to employee benefits. And so, that's generated some interest and has probably made that race somewhat more competitive than it might have been. The county auditor's race is an interesting one as well, with the current incumbent, John Federer, having made some significant changes to the way the office is run, and he would tout certainly some improvements that he claims have been made. The challenger, Nikki Crawford, actually used to work in the auditor's office and has made an issue of some of the concerns that she's raised regarding some records requests that she made and asking whether or not the refund that Mr. Federer was able to generate for some jurisdictions based on the reassessment fund, whether that might have been politically motivated or not. So that's generated some interest in that race. Those are three in particular, I think, that are going to be perhaps closer than it might normally have been.
Do you have a sense that President Obama's performance is going to have an impact on some of these local races?
It depends on the turnout, I guess. In the case of the auditor's race and in the case of the county commission's race, maybe not. But you get up to the state house race, and perhaps there might be a coattail effect. There's a lot of unrest, I think, in the electorate nationwide about the Obama presidency. And if you look at what the Democrats nationwide are relying on, it's turnout in the black community to try to offset what most would say would be some gains by the Republicans in the Senate and in the House, U.S. House. Whether that trickles down to these local races, I'm not sure. Again, if the minority turnout is higher, I think that would affect in a positive way the Democratic chances in some of these local races, yes.
Does Clark County tend to lean towards the Democratic side or Republican side these days? It seems like some folks believe that it's conservative at the ballot box around Clark County these days.
Well, I disagree with that. I think Clark County is a fairly competitive county. It's very similar to Ohio as a whole when you look at the fact that Ohio goes one way some years and the other way other years. Springfield is a significant base of support for the Democratic Party, but the surrounding unincorporated areas of Clark County are largely Republican-oriented, and they sort of offset each other in that sense. So that's why I say the 79th House race is a fairly competitive seat, because of the fact that Clark County is a big portion of that district, and Clark County is fairly competitive as far as the two parties go.
Well, Rob, thank you very much for that detailed breakdown. We certainly appreciate your time.
Sure, Wayne, no problem.
From 8 to 10 p.m. on Tuesday, WISO will bring you live coverage from NPR. Then at 10 p.m., we'll switch over to the Ohio Statehouse News Bureau for statewide election coverage. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO, public radio for the Miami Valley. On Thursday, November 6th, Charles Phoenix will bring his big retro slideshow back to the Dayton Art Institute. The show, which was previously here in 2012, highlights Americana as told through old Kodachrome slides and modern photos of retro slides. WISO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with Charles Phoenix ahead of his visit to the Miami Valley.
Did you find that when you started sharing the slides with others, that people had that kind of instantaneous connection that, you know, even younger people who maybe didn't grow up in the era of even of slideshows or the era that you're showing felt somehow connected to that kind of ideal that they show off?
You know, I know that it's a combination of my kind of enthusiasm and my expertise on, you know, kind of giving you the quickie ABC rundown of the significance of what we're seeing, the uniqueness of what we're seeing, and ultimately at the end of the day, making it entertaining and, you know, often bringing humor into it. You know, never laughing at it, always laughing with it. I mean, this is a celebration. What I do is I celebrate our culture. At least I feel I celebrate it. You know, classic and kitschy American life and style.
Now, when you come to a community like Dayton, Ohio, last time you were here, you went around and toured a lot of our surviving retro sites. I know you went up to Kay's in Troy. Do you do that with every community that you visit? Do you try to incorporate that place into your presentation?
As much as I possibly can, because it makes it more interesting for me to be able to switch up my performance and make it fresh, or at least partially fresh. I love to tell an audience how great something is, and they, you know, maybe they aren't aware, or they just don't know, or they've been looking at it all these years. But I'm completely, you know, I'm an out-of-towner, so I'm seeing things, you know, in your town that I'm pointing out things that I can't experience anywhere else. I mean, it's like I went to your town. I arrived here on Thursday, and, you know, I've been on a mad dash looking for what makes this city unique to me, you know, and these are the things, these are the places that I discovered that I'm going to go back to my hometown of Los Angeles and brag about that I got to experience.
Thank you so much. I like I said, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I'm really just so thrilled that you're coming back to Dayton.
Well, thank you so much.
WISO's Juliet Fromholt speaking with Charles Phoenix about his big retro slideshow, which returns to the Dayton Art Institute on Thursday, November 6th. To hear an extended version of this interview, tune in to this week's edition of Kaleidoscope Wednesday night beginning at 8 p.m. on WISO. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WISO, public radio for the Miami Valley. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. From November 7th through the 9th, Glen Helen will host a conference on climate crisis solutions. It will feature a number of keynote speakers, and organizers say a big part of the discussion will be around individuals and how they can respond to climate change. To tell us about the details of the conference, we have in studio Susan Jennings, Executive Director of the Arthur Morgan Institute for Community Solutions, and Faith Morgan, a past Executive Director. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Susan, let's start with a few more details about the purpose of the conference and what you hope will come out of it.
The conference is an opportunity for us to examine how individuals can respond to the threat of climate change. 2014 has really been an extraordinary year in terms of people's understanding of climate change. We have new IPCC reports, a new national climate assessment, and in general, people really are waking up to the fact that climate change is here and it's getting worse, and that we really it's time now for individuals at all levels in their personal lives and in their professional lives to really begin to make the changes necessary to cut our carbon emissions.
Faith, this is the sixth conference that has been held around climate change. And can you tell us a little bit about the history?
When my husband and I came back to Yellow Springs about 12, 13 years ago, we had learned about peak oil, which is the time when oil production reaches its peak worldwide. And so the first conferences were about that. We weren't thinking about climate change until 2006, when it just came on our radar, and we thought the same issues, but this climate change actually is more pressing. And so we started including that in our conferences. So the first conferences were in 2004, we held the first conference in the U.S. on peak oil and community solutions is what we called it. And then from then on, we started adding climate change.
And there are a number of sponsors, organizations joining together to make it a reality. Can you list those organizations for us?
Sure. On a local level, we have Tecumseh Land Trust, Glen Helen, Antioch University Midwest, and Antioch College.
We also have, on the West Coast, Post Carbon Institute, and our keynote speaker Friday night is coming from that organization. I often think of it as our sister organization on the West Coast, working on the same issues. That'll be Richard Heinberg for our Friday night keynote speaker.
He is the author of The Party's Over and 11 other books. You also have some other keynote speakers worth mentioning.
Yes. On Saturday during the day, we have Bob Brekka, who may be familiar with many of your listeners. He's a Yellow Springs resident and a professor at the University of Dayton. But he also works for the Potsdam Climate Institute in Germany during the summers. And he'll be here to talk about how IPCC reports are put together, and also about Germany and Europe in general, who are leading the way in terms of climate emissions.
And also renewable energy. It became really clear when Bob came back this summer after his time in Europe that the whole what was happening in Europe really could show the U.S. a lot about the things that we could do, because they're way ahead of what we're doing. I think Germany is sometimes up to 30% of their energy is coming from renewables, which is, as he said, people consider that the grid can't take more than 25%, but Germany is showing that that's not so.
Other keynote speakers we have are Mario Alberto Aristia Avila, who's coming to us from Cuba and who will be featured in Faith's upcoming film.
And let's talk about that film.
First of all, I am now the director of film for our organization, and I've done two films so far, documentary films. The first one was The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, which came out in 2006, which showed what happened in Cuba when the USSR pulled out and they had their massive economic collapse in 1990. And then in 2011, I went back to Cuba to see about doing another film, a follow-on, about what they're doing in their energy, what they call their energy revolution, which is a five-point plan to make the country more sustainable and have adequate energy supplies for everybody without increasing the energy use. And they've been very successful, and so we've invited Mario to come and speak about that and be part of the conference, because Cuba is really like Germany, but in a different way. It's way ahead of the rest of the world in reduction and energy efficiency.
We have Martin Heller, who's coming to us from the Center for Sustainable System Solutions at the University of Michigan, and he's going to be talking about life cycle assessment. So that's, as we have been writing or talk and speaking about the conference, we've been noting that there are tools that can help individuals make good choices if they're interested in being responsible members of the planetary community and reduce their carbon emissions, that there are many tools now that have not in the past been available to help people assess what the kind of changes that they can make in their individual lives. And so Marty will be speaking about the carbon impact of foods and how they can be measured.
We also have two people that I haven't heard speak before, which I'm very excited about. One is Jim Merkel, who wrote Radical Simplicity and really started the simplicity movement in the country. And he lives, I think, on $5,000 a year. And
yeah,
he's just I've heard he's a wonderful speaker. He'll be our keynote Saturday night speaker. And then Liz Walker, who started the Eco-Village at Ithaca 23 years ago after a walk from L.A. to a protest walk that she and another woman did with a lot of other people from L.A. to New York City. And I think one of the things that she will bring is, you know, how when people really have an inner sense of something needs to change, they can actually make an impact on their communities.
Well, you mentioned the individual and awareness over the situation. And, Susan, that goes back to something you mentioned at the start, that you believe there's an awakening and more people are becoming aware of climate crisis.
Yes.
But there are still segments of populations. There are groups of people who still don't have that consciousness. I'd like one or both of you to comment on perhaps where the messaging needs to go, maybe stemming through more conferences like these, or what you think needs to happen.
Do you mean in terms of the population who doesn't believe in climate change?
Well, maybe they do, but there's a lot going on in the world today, and maybe it's just not
high on
their priority list. Correct.
I think I actually think we're hitting a watershed there as well with books like Naomi Klein's "This Changes Everything." I think in general people are starting to see how climate change and perpetual war and economic collapse and economic disparities, that they really are all woven together, and that you can't take one piece of that issue and without really addressing all the different pieces. So I think in general that people are beginning to understand that. One of the issues that we struggle with, and that I know just from the response of people to the conference struggle with, is what can one person do? And I think the climate march in September, I think that a lot of people are feeling like these issues can only be dealt with on a political level or a policy level. So it seems somewhat chaotic to think that an individual can make a difference. But I think what we recognize by, you know, through our own lives and then looking at people like the Jim Merkles of the world, of which there are many, is that by making a personal commitment to become, you know, responsible in your own life and really understand what your personal actions, the impact of your personal actions, that then can lead to leadership in your community. It can lead to leadership in your profession. An example of this is and I don't know how widely this is known, but there's a sheriff in Bristol County, where I just moved here from Massachusetts. I believe his name is Sam Sutter, who recently let charges drop against a pair of activists who, with a lobster boat, had tried to stop or did stop a shipment of coal coming into a harbor. And he basically, the sheriff said that he felt that it was really important for people to understand what a huge issue climate change was, and that they were being responsible citizens. So that, in my mind, is somebody who's taking an individual, who's using their profession and sort of standing, taking leadership on a personal and professional level. And I think we see that more and more as people are waking up.
As with anything, educational often needs to start at a young age. So what do you think is happening there? What's going right? What needs to happen?
Well, I think I think there's interesting things going on at Yellow Spring schools right now with project-based learning. I understand that the second graders recently did a mapping of trees in their neighborhood, which I think the importance of that is for that young people start to really understand the natural world around them. And I think, again, that Yellow Springs is somewhat of a leader in that.
Well, I don't have a lot of knowledge about what's happening in schools. I did notice a few years ago when we were brought to the Yellow Springs schools to give some talks that some of the teachers in the high school were doing an excellent job of bringing awareness to their students. One of the reasons we're bringing Mario Arastia here is that he was in charge of the educational program in Cuba when they changed out all their incandescent light bulbs to fluorescent in 2005. They didn't force people to. It was a voluntary measure. And they realized from a previous experience that they had to educate people in order for them to choose to do it.
Well, let's remind our listeners about the details of the conference and how they can become involved.
Okay. The conference runs from Friday, November 7th, that's this coming Friday, through Sunday the 9th. There are two or three ways that people can connect with us. One is to come to the conference for the whole weekend, which would be wonderful, but we also have opportunities for people to go to the keynotes. Again, we have Richard Heinberg speaking at AUM Auditorium on Friday evening, and that's open to the general public. People can RSVP for that particular session. And then also on Saturday evening, we have Jim Merkel, author of Radical Simplicity, who's giving a keynote at Glen Helen, and people can sign up just for that keynote. And they can find us, they can sign up at our website, www.communitysolution.org.
I've been speaking with Susan Jennings and Faith Morgan of the Arthur Morgan Institute for Community Solutions. Ladies, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jerry.
Thank you.
Faith Morgan will be taking a film crew back to Cuba in 2015 to continue filming for Earth Island, Energy and Community, a documentary about Cuba's energy revolution and climate change mitigation measures. The film is a sequel to The Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil. Faith's first film, which has sold over 20,000 copies in 37 countries, has been translated into 15 languages and accepted into more than 80 film festivals, winning 9 awards. Coming up next on WYSO, Wyatt Sowers talks with Antioch students about their experiences at the People's Climate March in this month's edition of the Antioch Word podcast. The word is made for the Antioch College community by Antioch students working at WYSO.
I'm Wyatt Sowers, a Miller Fellow at WYSO and a class of 2017 student at Antioch College. Climate change has been a large topic of discussion lately. The International Panel on Climate Change recently released documents that stated if we continue to emit carbon at the rate that we are right now, there will be severe and irreversible impacts globally by the end of the 21st century. Even more distressing, the report says that even if we mitigate carbon emissions, there will still be irreversible damage done. Last September, there was a United Nations summit to discuss climate change. On September 21st, a few days before the summit, an estimated 400,000 people took to the streets of Manhattan for the People's Climate March to show solidarity in the need to take action against climate change. Among the marchers were Antioch students and faculty members, as well as residents of Yellow Springs. The Antioch community and the Yellow Springs community came together and got a bus, partially funded through the Sierra Club, to take them from Yellow Springs to the march in New York City. At 12 a.m. on September 21st, the night before the demonstration, Yellow Springs and Antioch community members got on the bus and arrived just in time for the march at 1 p.m. I talked to Antioch Class of 2017 students.
Lauren, Jesse.
I'm Hannah Craig. I am a second year at Antioch College.
My name is Ian Rosenthal, Class of 2017 at Antioch College.
Hi, my name is Frank Fertino. I'm a 2017er at Antioch College.
I'm Sean Allen, and I'm a rising second year at Antioch College.
I'm Perrin Ellsworth Heller, Antioch College, Class of 2017.
Right now, I am on the streets of New York with, I can't even count how many people are here right now for the People's Climate March.
I am at the People's Climate March in New York City.
We're on Park Avenue.
The bus from Yellow Springs to the Climate March took 55 people on a 13-hour ride to the city.
Why are you at the People's Climate March? I am here to help raise awareness for a bunch of environmental issues.
To show we want action on climate issues.
I'm here because I agree with the action and the message, and I hope that a movement can grow from this, because I think this is only the beginning.
I think that Antioch College needs to be a representative of positive change in climate change. We need to show our support of alternative ways of being in the world that don't involve the destruction of the world as we live.
Most students were at the march for the same reasons: to raise awareness for issues surrounding climate change and to show support for taking action against global climate issues.
Why do you think raising awareness is important?
I think raising awareness is important because there's only a short time to act, and with a delicate and as interwoven ecosystem as our planet is, we need to make sure that we act when we can act.
Frank Fortino shared a similar sentiment to many other Antioch students at the march.
Right now, we're not sustainable. We're living in a world that we're going to kill ourselves and everything around us if we don't actually look back and start to see our flaws.
You just heard from Antioch Class of 2017 students Frank Fortino, Lauren Jessing, Hannah Craig, Ian Rosenthal, Sean Allen, and Perrin Ellsworth Heller. Thanks for listening to this month's edition of the Antioch Word. Music for the Word was written, produced, and performed by Seth Kaplan. I'm Wyatt Sowers. Come back next month for another edition of the Antioch Word. right here on WYSO.org.
Should we be thinking about reserving spots for our great-grandchildren on glass-bottom boat tours of New Orleans and Manhattan? How much could sea levels rise, and when? Could it reach Ohio? University of Dayton professor Bob Brekka takes a look at the extreme possibilities of sea level rise in the future.
Imagine a map of the United States. Think about the southeastern part of the country, from the Texas Gulf Coast to Louisiana, past the mouth of the Mississippi, and then around the Florida Peninsula. Now imagine if the ancient Greek hero Odysseus, instead of wandering around the Mediterranean, had managed to make a voyage as far as Florida. He would have seen essentially the same coastline as today. Nothing has really changed in the geography, but it's going to. Climate change means that sea levels are rising and will rise more. The coast of the southeastern United States will look drastically different. Most of Florida has an elevation less than about 100 feet above sea level. Cities like Little Rock, Arkansas, Raleigh, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C. are a little more than 200 feet in elevation. I mention these numbers because we know that glaciers and ice caps are melting. If all the ice were to melt, most of it is on Greenland and especially Antarctica, it would add about 200 feet to the planet's oceans. So Florida, in the distant future, could become a collection of very tiny islands. The mouth of the Mississippi would move to around Memphis, Tennessee. Our descendants living in Ohio will be safe and could still visit New Orleans, perhaps with oceanfront cafes on the upper floors, now with water terraces, of some of the tall buildings. Of course, this could never happen, could it? Well, there's evidence from the far past that the Earth was often ice-free, but long before Homo sapiens were around. In fact, it's possible to get a rough idea of how much higher the average Earth temperature was at these times of ice-free conditions. A good estimate would be about 8 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is now. Continuing our current path of carbon dioxide emissions could lead to a global average temperature increase of approximately that magnitude. Goodbye, Florida, New Orleans, and New York City. Before looking at beachfront property in Little Rock or Raleigh, it's important to realize that the complete disappearance of Earth's ice sheets would take a few thousand years, typical geological times, so many people don't worry about it. When I think back 2,500 years to the time of Odysseus, I know that his adventures are part of our culture. I believe that people living 2,500 years from now will also be part of our culture. Our actions today are on a path to radically change the world. A theme running through ancient literature is that man's fate is often in the hands of the gods. In the modern world, we understand natural systems pretty well, and we have the power to prevent the worst of climate change and preserve, literally, the world as we know it. For WYSO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of the Renewable and Clean Energy Program at the University of Dayton. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wyso.org. That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org, a community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week. Coming up, The Book Nook.
American Radio Works documentary, schools across the country are trying new ways to teach based on brain science. Teachers say current techniques are failing.
We call that drill and kill. We'll just keep drilling you until we kill you, and then you will definitely hate math.
New approaches help students learn more deeply.
There's an aha moment. Oh, I know how to do that.
Listen for The Science of Smart from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday afternoon at 4 on WYSO.